Welcome to In Tune with the Opera Company of Philadelphia.
The place to learn everything you need to know about upcoming Opera Company productions.
I'm Mike Bolton, Director of Community Programs for the Opera Company, and sitting next to me is...
Maren Montalbano. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Maren.
We've got a very, very exciting production to talk about this time.
Yeah, we do. I got to tell you, I love Romeo and Juliet. It's really one of my favorite operas.
Oh, me too. And it's actually one of my favorite stories of all time, too. And it's been said that this opera is virtually one long love duet, which is perfect timing as it will be performed around Valentine's Day.
And, you know, it's not just the love duets that are amazing, but there's so many great solo moments in it, too. Juliet has the waltz song and the poison arias.
And Romeo's great garden scene aria and the arias for Mercutio and Stefano. But before we get ahead of ourselves, we should tell people what's coming up in this edition of In Tune with the Opera Company of Philadelphia.
Absolutely. You know, I think in this day and age, we're used to Shakespeare's plays being updated in the theater and in movies. And this production of Romeo and Juliet follows that contemporary tradition with what, I don't know, I think I got to say it's a pretty cool concept. This summer, we caught up with director Manfred Schreikofler and costume designer Richard St. Clair to talk about this particular production.
Also in this edition of In Tune, we'll have our Academy of Music Minute with the Academy's Operations Manager, Maureen Lynch. Learn about Charles Gounod. We'll have a complete plot synopsis, information on the amazing cast, including tenor Stephen Costello and soprano Eileen Perez, and much more.
All of this coming up. So stay tuned. We'll be right back to talk Romeo and Juliet with director Manfred Schreikofler.
Never in the history of romance were two lovers more star-crossed than Shakespeare's passionate Romeo and Juliet. Rising international stars Stephen Costello and Eileen Perez, real-life spouses and Academy of Vocal Arts alumni, return home to Philadelphia in the title roles. This new production paints the Capulets and Montagues as dueling fashion houses. Against a backdrop of models, paparazzi, and high style, Romeo and Juliet's love for each other unfolds to its deadly conclusion. Performances of Romeo and Juliet run from February 11th through February 20th for 5 performances only at the Academy of Music. Order your subscriptions today at www.operaphila.org or by calling 215-732-8400.
Hi, this is Mike Bolton, and you're listening to In Tune with the Opera Company of Philadelphia. We've embraced a variety of production styles at the Opera Company over the past few years. Traditional productions like Turandot, Italian Girl in Algiers, Aida, Rigoletto. Stylized productions like June Kaneko's interpretations of Madama Butterfly and Fidelio. And updated interpretations like the recent La Traviata, Gianni Schicchi, and The Rape of Lucretia. The Opera Company's mission is to mount innovative productions, whether traditional or not, that are thought-provoking, invigorating, and truly advance the art form. I sat down to talk with both Romeo and Juliet director Manfred Schreikofler and costume designer Richard St. Clair to talk about this updated production of Romeo and Juliet. We'll catch up with Richard in a moment, but Mr. Schreikofler talked to us about overcoming some of the challenges inherent in Romeo and Juliet for modern audiences, about how he met with Opera Company Artistic Director Robert B. Driver in Italy to discuss the possibility of collaboration, and bringing his vision of Romeo and Juliet to Philadelphia.
I told him, well, I'm working on a Romeo and Juliet concept. I want to put the story into the fashion world. And Robert was excited about this idea. And he told me, well, perhaps we are thinking on a Romeo and Juliet production too. And so he asked me, would it be possible to do it also in Philadelphia? Because after Philadelphia, the show will go to Italy.
How does Mr. Schreikofler prepare for a new production?
When I direct a show, I have to ask myself, how can I serve the composer, the libretto? How can I tell the story to people of today? We can no longer put a museum on stage for an audience of 2010. So we have to think what makes the old, beautiful story of Shakespeare work in our times. And when I put Romeo and Juliet only in the old costumes, okay, it will work, but it is museum. And young people sitting in our beautiful theater think opera is an old-fashioned thing. And I want the audience of today to look on the stage and say, well, it's a story of today.
We asked Mr. Schweighofer about his concept for Romeo and Juliet.
Romeo and Juliet is a story about young people, but young people have to fight against the establishment. And the fashion world is a world of establishment. And we see two young people fighting against this establishment. And the system does not allow them to marry, to have a relationship. And this is difficult to tell in our days, because we know our young kids, if they want to do something, they do it. Therefore, I thought that bringing the story to the fashion world, which is really a world where one label is fighting against the other label, could be helpful for this story. So Juliet is not only the daughter of the Capulet, but she is also the face selling, making money for the Capulets. The face of Juliet is on every banner in the city, on every bus, on every cab. You see Juliet's face everywhere. And therefore, it is not possible that Romeo Montagu is going into this family, because Romeo is the boy of the opposite fashion label. This is the story today of Romeo and Juliet.
With this updated version of the opera, some characters we would traditionally expect might have different roles in the opera. How is Manfred placing Shakespeare's characters into the 21st century? Here's what he said.
I have to ask myself when I'm studying the characters, who could be this character today? So today we don't have nurses, but today we have personal trainer. So this is a kind of nurse, what we know today, and what also the audience will recognize. When I show a Gertrude like a personal trainer, then they understand this is the most important consultant for this young Juliet. She trusts her, and there's no one people trust more than the personal trainer today, yeah? Tybalt is not only one of the Capulet family. He's the one who one day will take over the whole business. He one day will lead this Capulet family. You can imagine how tragic it is when Romeo kills Tybalt. It is not only a boy killing another boy. It is killing the nerve of the Capulet label. Count Paris, he is not a very good developed role in Gounod. He is singing one time. So I have to put Shakespeare flesh on the Gounod bones, because this will help the singer of Paris to understand what his role is. And so in our story, he is the editor of a big fashion newspaper. That makes him so important. That makes clear why there is a moment that Tybalt is talking to him. Because a marriage between Paris, the editor of the biggest fashion magazine, and Juliet, the daughter of the Capulet label, will be so useful in economic terms. And again, our story works.
That was Mike Bolton, the Opera Company's Director of Community Programs, talking with Romeo and Juliet director Manfred Schweighofer about this production. We'll be back in a moment to talk with OCP's costume designer Richard St. Clair about creating design concepts for not one, but two warring fashion houses. But up next, we'll take a moment to talk with Maureen Lynch, Operations Manager of the Grand Old Lady of Broad Street, for our Academy of Music Minute. Here's OCP chorus member Julianne Green to introduce this segment.
The Academy of Music opened its doors in 1857. Gounod's Romeo and Juliet had its world premiere 10 years later at the Théâtre Lyrique in Paris on April 27, 1867, and Philadelphia premiere in the Academy the following year, when the lovers were portrayed by soprano Minnie Hawk and tenor Emilio Pancani. Have you ever wondered what it was like to go to the opera in the late 1800s? Well, here's the Academy's Maureen Lynch to tell us more.
In those days, an evening at the opera meant truly an entire evening at the opera. It started with dinner in the Victorian restaurant that was then located at the lower level, followed by a three-hour-plus opera, and then it was also followed by a one act of an alternate opera. The evening of festivities continued after the opera into parties taking place in our ballroom on the balcony level and in lower-level salons that are no longer there. People also wonder, how were theaters lit? Because when we were built, the world and the Academy was lit by gaslight, and stage lights were, at that time, a series of gas lights at the lip of the stage that had a metal shield in front of them that flickered. As a matter of fact, when we did some restoration in the 1980s, we found the gas line and one of the gas shields that would have formed the row of stage lights. In 1884, the Academy began transitioning to electricity, a process that took about 12 years to get completely electrified. At that time, well, even when I came in 1973, the building did not have elevators. And in the 1980s, thanks to the incredible generosity of Ambassador and Mrs. Walter Annenberg, they installed two elevators that now service the upper levels and is a great convenience to our patrons. And someone asked once, what is the significance of the amphitheater entrance and exit on Locust Street? Well, Academy was built to allow 2,900 people to evacuate within, quote-unquote, 12 minutes. And this could be accomplished because fire towers lead to the exterior. The amphitheater entrance on Locust Street does access one of those fire towers. Although I have been told, and it sounds good, so it's my lie and you'll swear to it, that the term peanut gallery came about because the people in the upper levels would bring peanuts from the farms and eat peanuts up there.
Welcome back to In Tune with the Opera Company Philadelphia. I am Mike Bolton, the Opera Company's Director of Community Programs. We just heard a little bit about the Academy of Music and what opera going was like in the 1870s. But we're talking about Romeo and Juliet and this very fashion concept-y production of the opera. And we sat down with our costume director, Richard St. Clair, really done some phenomenal costumes for us, whether it's Traviata or Bohème or Aida, to recreating armchairs and frogs and fire in L'Enfant et les Sortilèges. But I think this might be the first time he's ever actually had to sort of create his own couture line for opera. So this past June, I sat down with Richard, and he shared his thoughts about bringing the catwalk to the opera house.
The concept for this show is that Romeo and Juliet are the favorite child of two fashion houses. And there are two different looks for the two different houses. We didn't want to do what often happens in theatrical productions of Romeo and Juliet, where you have the red team and the blue team, so that you're able to tell the two groups apart. We felt that if we found a very distinctive visual style for each house, if you see someone standing on the stage, you will understand that this is a character from the Montague family or this is a character from the Capulet family. And my feeling was that the Capulet family should be much more kind of over-the-top, opulent, I call it Versace cross-pollinated with LaCroix kind of look. And he had sent me this wonderful picture of the last Armani collection that he wanted for Romeo and his gang, which was this very simple, very chic, elegant look for the Montague family. So in a way, the Capulets are more is more, and the Montagues are less is more. And then the whole first part of the show is all about the ball where Romeo meets Juliet, which is a party being sponsored by the Capulets. The centerpiece of this party is the presentation of the Capulets' new line of summer 2011 fashion. We knew that that's where we were starting, and how do we work backwards from that to come up with a way of telling that story? I came up with this crazy idea that he loved, actually. In the movie An American in Paris, there's the big final Technicolor ballet that Gene Kelly and Leslie Caron dance in. And before that, there's a giant party that they go to. And the designers of that movie had a very clever idea, which was that the party was all designed in black and white. So your eyes were rested from color by seeing this black and white party. So then when the super Technicolor ballet happens, you're really ready for it. And so in the middle of this party is going to be this fashion show of the House Capuletti. So I said, what if that were really in Technicolor and we do this party in black and white? He loved that idea. So the things I showed him on the mannequin were sort of an illustration of the clothes for the Capulets in the party. Three weeks ago, I was on one of my junkets to Toronto, where I was at Malabar Limited pulling costumes and talking to them about building new costumes for our production of Otello, which opens on October 1st. And so I was sitting on the right-hand side of the trolley riding out to Malabar, and out of the corner of my eye, I see this sparkly baby doll dress, and I'm like, oh! What is that? And it was in my mind all day, like, I need to see that dress. So I got to Malabar and I worked all day. And at the end, I said, oh, you know what? I'm going to walk and I can stop at that store on the way back. So I walked back. And when I got to that store, there was this baby doll dress that is encrusted with these pale gold sequins and rhinestones. And for some reason, it looked to me like something a 14-year-old girl would think was a beautiful dress to wear to a party. And like teenagers do, they're trying to live in an adult world and act like grown-ups, but really, they're still kids. And so when I saw this dress, I was like, I'm never going to find a dress this perfect for Juliet for the ball scene ever again. And then, so I went in and I looked at it, and I didn't buy it that day. And I was like, should I buy that dress? And what if the director doesn't like it? And finally, I thought, you know what? Like, I'm never going to get another chance to get something so perfect. So then when Manfred came for meetings, I said, I can't wait for you to come to my shop because I've got to show you this dress. I had four mannequins dressed up like the Capulet ladies in the party. And then I had one mannequin dressed up like Juliet in this dress. And when he saw it, he just went like berserk over it. And then he said, oh, but see, this dress is so white and these other dresses are cream color. So let's put Romeo and Juliet in pure white and then have everybody else in black and cream so that we really pop them out. Which is something I do as a designer very often. The audience has to be able to discern who the star of an opera is. So we tend to put them in a little bit brighter colors or a little bit bigger trim or something that really pulls them out and pulls them forward. But he was like crazy over this dress. So we're going to do something very fun this summer, as Manfred discussed, with Juliet being the face of House Capuletti. So we're going to do a photo shoot with our leads, Eileen Perez and Stephen Costello, so that they can use her photograph on banners. And we'll actually do a photo shoot of her wearing this dress that she's being presented on in the party. And that dress will be used on the banners that are flown onto the set. All from this dress that I saw in a window in Toronto, you know, 3 weeks ago.
That was the Opera Company's costume director, Richard St. Clair, talking about his design concepts for this production. Make sure to keep an eye out for that little gold dress. Coming up, chorus member Julianne Green tells us what a performance is like if you're in the Opera Company Philadelphia Chorus. And we'll also have a review of the plot, information on Charles Gounod and the artists, and more. We'll be right back.
Company of Philadelphia offers all sorts of ways to learn about its season and productions. Do you like free preview recitals? Then come to A Taste of Opera at Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts. Like informative pre-curtain talks? Then check out Opera Overtures, held 1 hour before each opera. Love opera? Then help us celebrate National Opera Week from October 29th through November 7th. Here's what people are saying about the Opera Company of Philadelphia's free outreach programming.
Opera overtures are an enormous help in appreciating the overall productions. I've enjoyed every one I've been to.
Absolutely illuminating, fun, interesting backstories that are wonderful.
It's enjoyable and it's always educational and very fun.
And I love Taste of Opera. It gives me my fix and my high for the whole week and it keeps me glowing. I recommend it to everybody. And if you have never gone to an opera before, this is a great introduction.
What are you waiting for? Come join us and bring a friend. Find out more about the Opera Company of Philadelphia's educational and outreach events online at www.operaphila.org/community.
Looking for ways to have your children or grandchildren experience opera? Then mark your calendars for Saturday, February 12th, and bring them to the PNC Arts Alive Family Day at the Opera, a day-long open house event at the Academy of Music, where children of all ages can sing a little bit, dance a little bit, learn about their voice, and help them appreciate the world of opera. Plus, you'll be able to go into artist dressing rooms, stand on the stage of the Academy of Music, go into the orchestra pit, and more. PNC Arts Alive Family Day at the Opera, Saturday, February 12th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Sign up to get Opera Company email at www.operaphila.org to have more information and alerts delivered right into your email inbox. PNC Arts Alive Family Day at the Opera. Share the experience of opera.
Hi, this is Maren Montalbano, and we're back with In Tune with the Opera Company of Philadelphia. These programs offer so much and are so popular in attendance, and they're growing each year. For instance, over 10% of the audience now attends the pre-performance talks at the Sunday performances. So check them out.
Romeo and Juliet will keep the chorus members busy. They open the opera and appear in pivotal moments throughout it. But have you ever wondered what the chorus members do when they're not on stage? We caught up with OCP's chorister Julianne Green, and she told us what happens backstage before the wonderful singers that make up the Opera Company chorus make their entrance.
For most performances, we have a choral warm-up, so our call is generally an hour and a half before a curtain. We have a half an hour chorus warm-up with our chorus master. Then we have an hour for wigs and costumes and makeup. Sometimes our costumes are very elaborate, and our wigs can take a lot of time to put on. We have to have our makeup put on properly. So sometimes it takes a lot of time, to actually an hour, to get everything done. Other times we have very simple costumes, just a quick frock to throw on. Sometimes no wigs. We just wear maybe a hat or something and very simple makeup so we can get ready very quickly and then spend some time in the dressing room just hanging out, playing cards, clipping coupons, you know, being on our cell phones playing games.
Having been with the chorus for 10 years, certainly she must have a favorite story of some amusing onstage mishap.
I remember the second show that I was in was Elixir of Love, and our bel core, Teddy Tahu Rhodes, very tall, striking gentleman, was singing his aria, and he was on stage, and he knelt down to sing to Adina, and as soon as he went down on one knee, his pants ripped right up the middle. And, you know, he kind of slinked off stage with his hands behind him. Richard St. Clair, our costume director, swiftly remedied the situation and got him a new pair of pants. And that never happened again for the rest of the run. So. I think that's probably my most favorite funny memory.
Before reviewing Romeo and Juliet's plot, let's learn a bit about Charles Gounod.
Charles Gounod was beloved by opera lovers as the composer of such cherished operas as Faust and Romeo and Juliet, and known to many who have attended weddings as the composer of the Ave Maria, and to television buffs who love his music that was used as the theme music for the television show Alfred Hitchcock Presents. But who was this man who seems to have become such a part of our culture? Charles-François Gounod was born in Paris on June 17, 1818. His father, François, died when Gounod was 4, and his mother, Victoire, was an accomplished pianist who, after her husband's death, gave music lessons to help support the family. She was Gounod's first piano teacher, and it was evident from an early age that he was musically gifted. By age 7, he could read music amazingly well, and by age 10, could play most of Mozart's piano sonatas by heart. As Gounod grew older, his mother wanted him to focus on academics, so she enrolled him in a boarding school. He was a good student and got good grades, so as a reward, his mother would take him to the opera. Der Freischütz, Rossini's Otello, and a life-changing event when he saw Mozart's Don Giovanni when he was 13. He wrote, quote, "Hardly were we in the concert hall that I felt wrapped into a sort of a sacred terror, as in the approach of some impressive and redoubtable mystery. I felt, altogether in a confused emotion and up to then unknown, the desire and fear of what was going to happen before my eyes. I give up describing what I felt from the first accents of the sublime and terrible prologue. All that I remember is that God spoke to me." Well, Gounod's mother wasn't too terribly keen on the idea of having a son become a professional musician. It was too difficult a life, and she would rather her son become a soldier or a lawyer than a bohemian. But after such a life-changing event as occurred at Don Giovanni, Gounod's career choice was inevitable. At 13, he wrote a 4-page letter to his mother and begged her to allow him to become a musician. He wrote, "For me, music is such sweet company that I would be deprived of a very big happiness if I was prevented from feeling it." At age 17, in 1836, Gounod entered the Paris Conservatory with his mother's blessing. Here he studied counterpoint with Jacques Halévy, composition with Henri Barton, and 3 years into his studies there, Gounod won the Prix de Rome and left Paris at the age of 20 to study in Rome for 2 years. In Rome, he became acquainted with the music of Palestrina and other 16th century Renaissance masters. The liturgical music of these musicians led Gounod to write a significant amount of sacred music. Gounod returned to Paris in 1843 and accepted a position at the Chapel for Foreign Missions as the music director and church organist. Always a deeply religious man and influenced by his position at the chapel, Gounod decided to become a priest and entered a Carmelite monastery. 5 months into his stay there, he left the monastery and returned to secular life. The famous opera singer and composer Pauline Viardot acted as a mentor to him and helped him bring his very first opera, Sappho, to the stage with Viardot as the heroine. The work wasn't terribly successful and closed after only 7 performances. 2 years later, Gounod married the daughter of his former conservatory teacher and as a wedding gift was appointed to the directorship of the Orphean Theater and appointed by the communal schools of the city of Paris as the superintendent of instruction of singing. Gounod used these positions to help him pursue his operatic dreams. It took a few years for Gounod to strike operatic gold, but he did with Faust. Gounod didn't write big, spectacular grand operas. His operas were intimate. While Faust wasn't an overnight sensation at its premiere in 1859, he revised it and the opera became a huge success. Today, Faust remains part of the standard repertoire and was last produced by the Opera Company in Philadelphia in 2004 and starred Mary Mills, Richard Bernstein, Stephen Powell, and in the title role, William Burden, who returns to the Opera Company this season for the U.S. premiere of Hans Werner Henze's Phaedra in June. Yet, of 13 operas, the only one that could touch Faust's popularity was Romeo and Juliet. Romeo and Juliet is frequently produced for singers who can dramatically pull off the title roles, and the Opera Company is thrilled to be able to present this opera with Eileen Perez and Stephen Costello as the eponymous lovers.
Hi, this is Maren Montalbano, and did you know, there have been at least 24 operas based on Romeo and Juliet. The first dates from 1776, a Singspiel by Georg Benda that's not particularly faithful to Shakespeare, especially in that there's a happy ending. But other operas inspired by the story include Giulietta e Romeo by Riccardo Zandonai, who is probably most remembered for his steamy veristic version of Francesca da Rimini. The Opera Company of Philadelphia last performed Bellini's I Capuletti e I Montecchi in 2002 with Anna Netrebko as Juliet and Ruxandra Donnoz in the trouser role of Romeo. Gounod's Romeo and Juliet premiered in 1867 in Paris's Théâtre Lyrique. It's the ninth of his 13 operas. Originally, the opera was to be performed as an opera comique with spoken dialogue in between the numbers, but the entire opera was planned to be very close to Shakespeare, following scenes and dialogues as close as possible. However, during rehearsals and for the first production, he wrote recitatives in place of the dialogue and added what is perhaps the most famous number from the opera, Juliet's waltz song, Je veux vivre. The celebrated coloratura aria was added for Marie-Caroline Cavallo. Juliet's fourth act poison aria was too heavy for Madame Cavallo's voice, so it was cut, and the brilliant waltz aria was added for her. The opera was an immediate success and was quickly booked into theaters throughout Europe within months of its premiere. It made it to Philadelphia just 8 months after the premiere in Paris.
Hi, this is Mike Bolton, and you're listening to In Tune with the Opera Company of Philadelphia. Now for a recap of the opera's plot from the perspective of this production, which we know is set in the world of high fashion and haute couture. But the houses in question are warring fashion houses. The House of Montague, of which Romeo is a member, and the House of Capulet, whose iconic supermodel is the Capulet daughter, Juliet. When the opera opens, the chorus is dressed in work clothes, and some are sewing diligently at their sewing machines. They introduce the story in a style similar to that of a Greek chorus and tell of the rivalry between the Capulet and the Montague houses, summarizing the tragedy that is about to unfold. And amidst this very public multi-million-dollar world of fashion, runways, paparazzi, we have this intimate family drama, this tender story of two young people whose love is crushed in their fight to free themselves to live their own lives. We have idealism versus materialism, public glare versus private sanctuary. Guests gather at a masked ball in the Capulet house for the unveiling of the new spring collection and post-party. Tybalt, the infamous publicity-seeking, hot-headed heir apparent of the House of Capulet, waits for his cousin Juliet, the face and supermodel of the house, to arrive. Paris, the editor-in-chief of the leading fashion magazine, is at the party. Tybalt talks to Paris about marrying Juliet. What a wonderful pair they would make. He, a prominent fashion editor, and she, the house's supermodel. The business arrangement could be very profitable for both companies. Capulet enters and announces the arrival of his daughter before inviting the guests to see the collection. Romeo, from the rival House of Montague, sneaks into the party with his friends Mercutio and Benvolio, invading this exclusive event. They are there to spy on the competition. Romeo tells his friends of a dream that he's had, which fills him with foreboding, but Mercutio dismisses it, saying it's all the work of the fairy queen Mab, the empress of dreams and illusions. His tale becomes a game for the haughty models. Romeo suddenly sees Juliet and is instantly drawn to her, but his friends drag him away, leaving Juliet alone with her personal trainer, Gertrude. She confesses to Gertrude that she has no desire to marry and vows to break free from this glitter and glamour world to live a life of her own, not the life that her father has dictated for her. Gertrude departs, and Romeo, in his full masquerade regalia, seizes the opportunity and furtively approaches Juliet. Their chemistry and attraction for each other is palpable. But Tybalt returns, causing a commotion, and the two lovers realize their identities.
she the face of the House of Capulet and he of the Montague Fashion House. Their family's rivalry could never allow them to be together. Romeo runs out and Tybalt wishes to fight the Montague faction, but the Capulet stops him, saying that the party should continue. Later that night, Romeo breaks into the Capulet penthouse courtyard, sneaking his way through security alarms and more as his friends taunt him. He muses on his feelings for Juliet and says that love's intensity has disturbed his very being. Juliet appears and Romeo hides, secretly watching her. When he finally reveals himself, the two profess their love for one another. In the midst of all this, servants and Gertrude interrupt the pair, but they manage to steal one last kiss and impulsively decide to follow their hearts and marry the next day. At daybreak, Romeo rushes to his spiritual guru, Brother Lawrence, to tell him of his love for Juliet. Brother Lawrence is amused by Romeo's fickleness, as he was in love with another just the other day. But when Juliet arrives, it's clear that the bond she shares with Romeo is powerful. The two beg Brother Lawrence to join them in holy matrimony. Convinced of their love and hoping that the marriage will end the rivalry between the two families, Lawrence unites the pair. Outside the Capulet compound, Romeo's friend Stefano provokes a fight with several of the Capulets. Mercutio and Benvolio arrive, followed shortly by Tybalt and Paris. Tybalt and Mercutio fight. Romeo arrives and tries to keep the peace. He urges Tybalt to forget the family's rivalry. Tybalt ignores him and, in the scuffle, fatally wounds Mercutio. Romeo avenges the death of his friend and in retribution attacks Tybalt, killing him in the brawl. Duke, an influential fashion promoter and entrepreneur, arrives with paparazzi in tow. Both families call for justice and Duke banishes Romeo from Verona. It is daybreak in Juliet's apartment. Romeo has secretly spent his wedding night with his wife before fleeing Verona. Juliet has forgiven Romeo for killing her cousin. After all, Tybalt would have killed Romeo, who defended himself. They sing of their love for each other, but Romeo pulls away from their embrace when he realizes that it is morning. Juliet refuses to believe that morning has come already, but the two say their goodbyes as Romeo flees into exile. Capulet arrives and tells his daughter that she will marry Paris later that day. Depressed and alone with Brother Lawrence, Juliet tells him that she would rather die than marry Paris. Brother Lawrence suggests an alternative. He gives her a sleeping potion that will make her appear dead, but when she awakes, Romeo will be at her side. Juliet agrees and manages to summon all her courage to drink the potion. Capulet returns with family, guests, and photographers to lead Juliet to the wedding, but Juliet collapses and all presume that she's dead. Juliet lies in Capulet's tomb, a room encased in mirrors. And not having received Brother Lawrence's note about the plan and hearing of Juliet's death, Romeo has returned to Verona and arrives at the tomb. Mourning the loss of his wife, he gazes down at her and is amazed that death has not robbed her of her beauty. Determined to join his wife in eternity, he drinks a vial of poison. Barely has the vial fallen from Romeo's hand when Juliet begins to wake from her slumber. The two sing once more of their love. As Romeo begins to succumb to the poison, Juliet pulls out Romeo's weapon and mortally injures herself. The two ask God for his forgiveness as they die in each other's arms.
You're listening to In Tune with the Opera Company of Philadelphia. I'm Maren Montalbano. Romeo and Juliet has a rich history in Philadelphia. The last time the opera was mounted professionally in Philadelphia was when the opera company produced it in 1994 with a cast that featured the young Richard Leach and Hae Kyung-hong as the lovers.
And in this production, the opera company is thrilled to welcome Philadelphia native Stephen Costello and his wife, Eileen Perez, both of whom are AVA alumni, back to the Academy of Music stage. Now, the two of them just performed La Boheme out in Cincinnati, and one critic at the Cincinnati Enquirer commented, quote, "One could hardly wish for a finer ensemble of singing actors than these Bohemians, led by the poet Rodolfo, wonderfully sung by Stephen Costello, and the consumptive seamstress Mimi, a radiant Eileen Perez. It was impressive to see how beautifully they could sing." Their last appearance with the Opera Company in Philadelphia was in 2009 as The Lovers in Puccini's Gianni Schicchi. Stephen was also in the East Coast premiere of David de Chiara and Bernardo Zan's Cyrano, and Eileen debuted with the Opera Company as Marcellina in Fidelio in 2008. But since then, they have been singing literally all over the world. Both have performed at the Salzburg Festival. Stephen opened the season at Covent Garden in a concert performance of Donizetti's Linda di Chamonix, and also had a very high-profile premiere with Jake Heggie's new opera, Moby Dick, for Dallas Opera.
And Eileen has sung Amelia to Placido Domingo's Simon Boccanegra at La Scala, sang Violetta at the Vienna State Opera and the San Francisco Opera, and has toured Japan with the Salzburg Festival. With both of these young singers in demand internationally, we're so pleased to be able to present them in the city they call home. Joining them will be a singer very familiar to Opera Company audiences, baritone Marion Popp. We've seen Marion in the title role of David de Chiara and Bernard Uzan's Cyrano, and in 2009 as an over-the-top grandfather clock and a very sexy cat in Ravel's L'Enfant et les Sortilèges, and as Marco in Gianni Schicchi. In the pit, we've got the wonderful Canadian maestro Jacques Lacombe, who has conducted several productions for OCP, including Werther, Macbeth, The Pearl Fishers, Faust, and more.
You know, and this is really a spectacular opera for both Stephen and Eileen. They both have these stunning, beautiful voices with amazing, amazing high notes. And they're just so completely believable as young people in love on stage.
Well, it doesn't hurt that they're married in real life, too. I mean, that chemistry just flies over the footlights and envelops the entire theater.
And I think Mercutio is such a great role for Marion Popp. From the Cyrano and L'Enfant operas, we know how wonderful his linguistic skills are. And as Mercutio is very much an acting role, you know, you need this sort of bravura and good comic timing and both qualities, which Marion has in spades.
Now, if you're interested in getting tickets to Romeo and Juliet, subscription packages are on sale now on our website at www.operafilla.org or by calling 215-732-8400.
To learn more about Charles Gounod and Romeo and Juliet, there are a whole slew of ways. So don't forget, we have our Taste of Opera pre-preview recital at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts on February 6th from 2 to 3 p.m. Reservations are required for Taste of Opera, but you can make them by emailing your name, address, and the number in your party to outreach@operafilla.org. And mark your calendars for Saturday, February 12th, for the PNC Arts Alive Family Day at the Opera. It's an entire day of activities for children and adults of all ages from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Academy of Music. There will be interactive activities. You'll get to meet company artisans who make magic happen in the theater for each production, a hair and makeup demonstration, costume fashion show, stage combat demonstrations, and more. So for information on that program, you can call 215-893-5927.
Another way to learn more about Romeo and Juliet is to come to Opera Overtures, which is our free 30-minute pre-curtain feature held in the Parquet Circle section of the Academy of Music 1 hour before each performance. For more information on all of these events, log on to our website at www.operafilla.org/community.
These are all great events that you can bring a friend or a loved one to, and they're great ways to introduce your friends to opera in an informal and entertaining way. This wraps up our podcast for Romeo and Juliet. Special thanks, of course, to Academy of Music Operations Manager Maureen Lynch, Manfred Schweighofler, and Richard St. Clair for sharing their ideas on this amazing production, to Julianne Green and Rebecca Whitlow for lending their voices, and of course to our co-host, Maren Montalbano, for their help with these podcasts.
And be sure to check out our other podcasts on these season's operas. If you have any questions or comments, please send them via email to outreach@operafilla.org. That's outreach@operaphila.org. Thank you again for joining us. I'm Maren Montalbano.
And I'm Mike Bolton. In Tune with the Opera Company of Philadelphia is produced, edited, and engineered by yours truly. And I hope to see you at the opera.
Thank you.